welcome back. Last time we finished up in Numbers chapter 4, verse 6, which gave instructions for preparing the Ark of the Covenant to be moved from place to place. And those instructions ended up with, and shall spread over it a cloth wholly of blue, and shall put in the staves thereof. Which makes it sound like the staves, or the carrying poles, were not already in the rings of the Ark. But that contradicts previous instructions that were given back in the book of Exodus. You know, I puzzled about this for a while, but I think I finally decided that it's talking about putting the poles through openings in the blue covering cloth, not through the rings of the Ark. And presumably you could do that without removing the poles from the rings. Just like you don't have to take your arms out of their sockets to put your shirt on. So let's move on. The next piece of furniture to be moved is the holy coffee table, as I call it. And that's mentioned in the next verse, verse 7. And upon the table of shewbread they shall spread a cloth of blue, and put thereon the dishes, and the spoons, and the bowls, and covers to cover withal. And the continual bread shall be thereon. And they shall spread upon them a cloth of scarlet, and cover the same with a covering of badger skins, and shall put in the staves thereof. Now that's the same verbiage that they used for the ark, you know, for the carrying poles of the ark. But for the holy coffee table, the table of shewbread, as it calls it here, they actually would have had to insert the carrying poles into the rings at the corners of the table, probably, because, you know, they hadn't been told to leave those inserted, and they would have been in the way if they'd left them in, you know. The Yahwehlians would have been bumping their shins on them when they went to get a bite of shewbread. So, I don't know. There's an alternative interpretation that while the ark's poles wouldn't have had to actually be inserted, they would have had to be adjusted. And that's what it was talking about back in verse 6. But the Hebrew verb in question usually means to insert. So I don't know if I can buy that one. Maybe it just means to insert them into whatever they need to be inserted into, you know, to shove the poles in whatever holes they're not already in. Whether those are the rings of the furniture or the holes in the cloth or in the badger skin covering or whatever. And by the way, don't put too much stock in that badger skin thing. The Hebrew word tahas that is translated in the King James Version as badger is rendered in various other translations as goat, porpoise, manatee, seal, and fine leather. I kid you not. So it's pretty clear that the translators didn't really know what tahas meant. Some translations just say skin without specifying what it's a skin of. And they shall take a cloth of blue and cover the candlestick of the light, and his lamps, and his tongs, and his snuff dishes, and all the oil vessels thereof, wherewith they minister unto it. And they shall put it and all the vessels thereof within a covering of badger skins, and shall put it upon a bar. A bar meaning a pole or a beam or something like that. You know, they're going to carry the bundle containing the holy candelabra on this pole, probably between two carriers. And upon the golden altar they shall spread a cloth of blue, and cover it with a covering of badger skins, and shall put to the staves thereof. And they shall take all the instruments of ministry, wherewith they minister in the sanctuary, and put them in a cloth of blue, and cover them with a covering of badger skins, and shall put them on a bar. And they shall take away the ashes from the altar, and spread a purple cloth thereon. Now, you may remember that back in Leviticus 6:13, you probably don't remember the actual verse, but it said that the fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. It shall never go out. But doesn't this contradict that? You know, obviously they couldn't spread a purple cloth over the altar if it still had fire burning on it. And you're going to tell me I'm ridiculous because you can't keep fire burning on the altar while you're moving it. So obviously the fire shall never go out. Just means it should never go out while it's stationary, not while it's being moved. But isn't that a lot like someone saying that the pole shall not be removed from the ark? It doesn't apply if you have to take them out to put the cloth covering on it. I'm just saying. And they shall put upon it all the vessels thereof, wherewith they minister about it, even the censers, the flesh hooks, and the shovels, and the basins, all the vessels of the altar. And they shall spread upon it a covering of badger skins, and put to the staves of it. So they'd carry this holy barbecue grill on two poles, and the bundle of grilling utensils and such on a separate pole. And again, it would be hard on the badger skins if there was still fire burning on the altar. And when Aaron and his sons have made an end of covering the sanctuary and all the vessels of the sanctuary as the camp is to set forward, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to bear it. But they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. These things are the burden of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation. So they were warned not only not to touch the ark, but not to touch any of the holy furniture. You know, was the coffee table as dangerous as the ark? I don't think so. But I guess it wasn't a bad idea to instill a healthy respect for it and the candelabra and the barbecue grill too, as well as the ark. At any rate, at this point, everything was covered in multiple layers of skins and cloths and was further insulated by the use of the wooden carrying poles. So it would have actually been kind of difficult for them to actually touch any of the holy furniture anyway. And to the office of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, pertaineth the oil for the light, and the sweet incense, and the daily meat offering, and the anointing oil, and the oversight of all the tabernacle, and of all that therein is, in the sanctuary, and in the vessels thereof. Eleazar was the eldest of Aaron's two remaining sons, after the two that were killed off by the ark. So, you know, he gets the responsibility for supervising the care of the most important items in the tabernacle. And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, cut ye not off the tribe of the families of the Kohathites from among the Levites. Now, this is kind of an odd thing to say, because the Kohathites are not a tribe. It says, cut ye not off the tribe of the families of the Kohathites. You know, the Levites are the tribe. The Kohathites are just one of the families of the tribe of Levi. But they do seem to be the most important Levite family, since they are assigned to care for the most important furnishings of the tabernacle and the most dangerous ones. But thus do unto them that they may live and not die, when they approach unto the most holy things. Aaron and his sons shall go in and appoint them every one to his service and to his burden. But they shall not go in to see when the holy things are covered, lest they die. Now, I think that means when they're being covered, they should not go in lest they die. Presumably, it would be okay once they are covered. But once they're covered, it might be hard to tell what was in what bundle, especially with the smaller items. So I guess that's why Aaron and his sons had to point out which bundles the Kohathites were responsible for. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, take also the sum of the sons of Gershon throughout the houses of their fathers by their families, From 30 years old and upward until 50 years old shalt thou number them. All that enter in to perform the service, to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. So you couldn't serve in the tabernacle unless you were at least 30 years old. And once you reached 50, you faced forced retirement from that duty anyway. I guess you could do other priestly duties. This is the service of the families of the Gershonites to serve and for burdens. And they shall bear the curtains of the tabernacle and the tabernacle of the congregation, his covering, and the covering of the badger skins that is above upon it, and the hanging for the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the hangings of the court, and the hanging for the door of the gate of the court, which is by the tabernacle, and by the altar round about, and their cords, and all the instruments of their service, and all that is made for them, so shall they serve. At the appointment of Aaron and his sons shall be all the service of the sons of the Gershonites, in all their burdens and in all their service, and ye shall appoint unto them in charge all their burdens. Now, notice they didn't have to be as careful about the Gershonites. There's no, you know, warning lest they die, you know. Because, you know, what they were going to be carrying wasn't dangerous like the ark and possibly the rest of the holy furniture. We're just talking the hangings and such that were in view pretty much all the time anyway. So it didn't matter if they saw them and probably didn't matter if they touched them. I don't know. This is the service of the families of the sons of Gershon in the tabernacle of the congregation. And their charge shall be under the hand of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. Ithamar being Aaron's youngest son. So, you know, he supervises the care of the less important items in the tabernacle, the less deadly ones. As for the sons of Merari, thou shalt number them after their families by the house of their fathers. From 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, shalt thou number them. Every one that entereth into the service to do the work of the tabernacle of the congregation. And this is the charge of their burden, according to all their service in the tabernacle of the congregation, the boards of the tabernacle, and the bars thereof, and the pillars thereof, and sockets thereof, and the pillars of the court round about, and their sockets, and their pins, and their cords, with all their instruments, and with all their service. And by name ye shall reckon the instruments of the charge of their burden. This is the service of the families of the sons of Merari, according to all their service, in the tabernacle of the congregation, under the hand of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. And Moses and Aaron, and the chief of the congregation, numbered the sons of the Kohathites after their families, and after the house of their fathers, from 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, every one that entereth into the service for the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. And those that were numbered of them by their families were 2,750. These were they that were numbered of the families of the Kohathites, all that might do service in the tabernacle of the congregation, which Moses and Aaron did number according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And those that were numbered of the sons of Gershon throughout their families and by the house of their fathers, from 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, every one that entereth into the service for the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. Gee, where's Reader's Digest when you need them? Even those that were numbered of them throughout their families by the house of their fathers were 2,630. These are they that were numbered of the families of the sons of Gershon, of all that might do service in the tabernacle of the congregation, whom Moses and Aaron did number according to the commandment of the Lord. And those that were numbered of the families of the sons of Merari throughout their families by the house of their fathers, from 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, Everyone that entereth into the service for the work in the tabernacle of the congregation, even those that were numbered of them after their families, were 3,200. You know, they could have really used an appendix with a table showing all this stuff instead of, you know, writing it all out over and over again in the main text. But I guess they hadn't developed that technique yet. These be those that were numbered of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moses and Aaron numbered according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. All those that were numbered of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron and the chief of Israel numbered after their families and after the house of their fathers. We're coming up on the grand total now. From 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, every one that came to do the service of the ministry and the service of the burden in the tabernacle of the congregation, even those that were numbered of them were 8,540. According to the commandment of the Lord, they were numbered by the hand of Moses, every one according to his service and according to his burden. Thus they were numbered of him as the Lord commanded Moses. Chapter 5. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper and every one that hath an issue, and whosoever is defiled by the dead. Both male and female shall you put out, without the camp shall you put them, that they defile not their camps, in the midst whereof I dwell. And the children of Israel did so, and put them out without the camp, as the Lord spake unto Moses, so did the children of Israel. But you got to keep the camp safe. We talked about this already back in Sermons 44, I believe, the episode Clean and Unclean Food and People. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, when a man or woman shall commit any sin that men commit, to do a trespass against the Lord, and that person be guilty, feel guilty, I think is what it means, then they shall confess their sin which they have done, and he shall recompense his trespass with the principal thereof, and add unto it the fifth part thereof, and give it unto him against whom he hath trespassed. So if you cheated somebody and felt guilty about it, you had to reimburse them for that amount that you had cheated them out of, plus a 20% penalty. And if they had passed away already, you'd pay that amount to their heirs. But if the man have no kinsman to recompense the trespass unto, let the trespass be recompensed unto the Lord, even to the priest, beside the ram of the atonement, whereby an atonement shall be made for him. And every offering of all the holy things of the children of Israel, which they bring unto the priest, shall be his. And every man's hallowed things shall be his. Whatsoever any man giveth the priest, it shall be his. So the priests get a windfall in a case like that. Now this next part deals with a different kind of cheating. You know, talked about cheating somebody out of money, but this is going to talk about how to determine whether a man's wife has been cheating, has been unfaithful to him. And it is a very occult sounding, almost voodoo type ritual, which I don't think we've seen in the Bible up to this point. And it, you know, it kind of makes you wonder why an advanced race like the Yahwehlians would recommend that the Israelites engage in this sort of superstitious business. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's see what the ritual is before we criticize it. Maybe there'll be a reason, a good reason. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, If any man's wife go aside and commit a trespass against him, and a man lie with her carnally, and it be hid from the eyes of her husband, and be kept close, and she be defiled, and there be no witness against her, neither she be taken with the manner, and the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be defiled, or if the spirit of jealousy come upon him, and he be jealous of his wife, and she be not defiled. So it doesn't matter whether she's guilty or not. Then shall the man bring his wife unto the priest, and he shall bring her offering for her, the tenth part of an ephah of barley meal. He shall pour no oil upon it, nor put frankincense thereon, for it is an offering of jealousy, an offering of memorial, bringing iniquity to remembrance. And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. Now, does this mean she was brought into the presence of the Ark of the Covenant? Likely not into the actual Holy of Holies, where the Lord sat in the mercy seat atop the Ark between the two cherubim. But maybe just outside of it or something. Anyway, that seems to be the way the show art depicts it. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthen vessel, and of the dust that is in the floor of the tabernacle the priest shall take, and put it into the water. Now, I believe this is the first time that the term holy water is used in the King James Bible. And presumably it means water from the laver, which would have been nearby, next to the altar, the holy barbecue grill. The priest used that same water, so it wasn't just any old water. And the dust wasn't just any old dust either. It was from the floor of the tabernacle, so it had been in the presence of Yahweh. It was holy dust. And they put the holy dust in the holy water. And the priest shall set the woman before the Lord, and uncover the woman's head, and put the offering of memorial in her hands, which is the jealousy offering. And the priest shall have in his hand the bitter water that causeth the curse. And the priest shall charge her by an oath, and say unto the woman, if no man have lain with thee, and if thou hast not gone aside to uncleanness with another instead of thy husband, be thou free from this bitter water that causeth the curse. But if thou hast gone aside to another instead of thy husband, and if thou be defiled, and some man have lain with thee beside thine husband, then the priest shall charge the woman with an oath of cursing, and the priest shall say unto the woman, the Lord make thee a curse and an oath among thy people, when the Lord doth make thy thigh to rot and thy belly to swell. And this water that causeth the curse shall go into thy bowels to make thy belly to swell and thy thigh to rot. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. Now, amen means so be it. So in effect, she'd be agreeing to the curse, to abide by the terms of the curse. And the priest shall write these curses in a book, and he shall blot them out with the bitter water. And he shall cause the woman to drink the bitter water that causeth the curse, and the water that causeth the curse shall enter into her and become bitter. Now, it's not clear to me whether or not the bitter water that he used to blot out the curses is returned to the container that she's going to drink from. If it is, then I guess there's not only dust in the water, but ink as well, or whatever passed for ink back in those days. I'm not sure what they used. Then the priest shall take the jealousy offering out of the woman's hand, and shall wave the offering before the Lord, and offer it upon the altar. And the priest shall take an handful of the offering, even the memorial thereof, and burn it upon the altar, and afterwards shall cause the woman to drink the water. And you can see a depiction of that moment in the show art. She's drinking the holy water mixed with the dust, and maybe a little bit of the ink, or whatever it was, where the priest blotted out the curse with it. And you can see the laver behind her in the corner of the altar on the far left, and the writing table where the priest wrote out the curse over on the right. And I guess that container at his feet is what contained the grain offering that she brought with her. It looks like another priest behind him has a tray with maybe some of that grain on it. Maybe that's where he got the handful to burn on the altar from. I don't know. And when he hath made her to drink the water, then it shall come to pass that if she be defiled and have done trespass against her husband, that the water that causeth the curse shall enter into her and become bitter, and her belly shall swell, and her thigh shall rot, and the woman shall be a curse among her people. Now, this kind of reminds me of the way voodoo works. You know, if you believe that some sort of voodoo ritual is going to make you sick, you'll get sick. I mean, a while back I convinced myself that I'd eaten some bad turkey lunch meat, and you know, I kept imagining that I had symptoms of food poisoning. Well, it turned out I didn't have food poisoning. But because I believed I did, I kind of felt like I did. So despite, you know, this ritual, it's called the Sota ritual, by the way. Despite this ritual, the Sota ritual, sounding like pure superstition, there might be some sound psychology behind it. You know, if the woman's guilty, the bitter water might not actually cause her belly to swell, but it might make her feel like her belly was swelling, you know, and her reaction to that would be an indicator of guilt. Now, I don't know what this business about the thigh rotting indicates. The thigh may be some sort of euphemism for the genitals. I don't know. And if the woman be not defiled, but be clean, then she shall be free and shall conceive seed. Now, some people think this means that she would get pregnant right then. But I don't see how that would be supposed to set her husband's mind at ease. You'd think it would do just the opposite. I think it just means that she can be impregnated by her husband at some point in the future. It's okay for them to go ahead and start trying to get pregnant. And some people think that if she's guilty, she'd have a miscarriage. But, you know, does a miscarriage cause a woman's belly to swell? Really? I didn't know that. When their bellies swell, it's usually a sign that they're getting more pregnant, not less. Anyway, I think when it says her belly shall swell, it just means she'll get a tummy ache. I don't know why people try to read so much into verses like this, and they overcomplicate things. This is the law of jealousies. When a wife goeth aside to another instead of her husband and is defiled, or when the spirit of jealousy cometh upon him, and he be jealous over his wife, and shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall execute upon her all this law. Then shall the man be guiltless from iniquity, and this woman shall bear her iniquity. So what I think it's saying here is that regardless of whether the man was justified in being jealous or not, he wasn't to blame. It was the woman's fault, either because she really had been unfaithful or because she had behaved in such a way that she aroused his suspicions. Well, that's the end of chapter 5, and that's going to just about do it for this episode of Sermons. We'll pick it up next time with chapter 6. Until then, keep the faith. Don't let your belly swell, and keep on doing that voodoo that you do so well.